So we're going to do three classes that we're going to discuss tonight.
Thank you.
Sure. And
I'll take two more copies from my sister. They'll be going next.
And two of them are, I think, two of the more cryptic songs that are predominantly Lennon songs. And, of course, this week is John Lennon was murdered on December 8th, 1980. So it's this week, a few days from now. And he was killed a few blocks from here, the Dakota Building in 72nd and Central Park West. And I was reading a little bit about what happened that night. And it's a little bit eerie, but there's a... The person who killed him... Oh, what's his name again? Do you remember his name? I forgot his name. So...
A white guy.
Yeah.
That sounds crazy.
Yeah, so John Lennon and I had gone to a recording studio with Yoko Ono, and...
Can't stand up.
What?
Can't stand up.
Yeah, so, so that night they had gone out, and on his way out the door, there was like a bunch of fans outside kind of wait. I guess people would always kind of wait around the building to see if he'd show up or leave. Yeah. So one of the people that was waiting there was the guy who eventually killed him. And there's a picture of John Lennon like signing an album of his that very night as he went out. And then that guy came back, and I think Dakota has an entranceway. You can drive into like a courtyard and then get out, so you don't have to be let out on the street. But for some reason that night he got let out on the corner, and then he was shot like at 10:30, so pretty late that night. My interest in the Beatles, you know, goes back. I guess, you know, I have a different experience because I was a child of parents who grew up in the 60s. And for me, the Beatles were my parents' music. And so as a young kid, I wasn't into it because that was my parents' music. And kids, you know, rarely like their parents' music. They like their music. And so I kind of had ignored the Beatles for most of my childhood. And then... think about junior year of high school, I started listening to it again and start to realize that the quality of what they were doing was so much better than anything I'd heard before that I had to give it a second chance. Then in 1996, they came out with the Beatles Anthology, which is like a 6 or 8 part documentary. I forgot what channel did it. And that was just like this all-encompassing, you know, Beatles history with all the music of it, and it was wonderful. And they came out with new CDs for that that I got, and so I kind of became a hobby of mine. I was interviewed in 2006 by the Jewish paper in San Francisco. October 13, 2006, a writer named Dan Pine had found out that I was a Beatles fan, and so he interviewed me about the Beatles, because he had been a big Beatles fan and how it connects to Judaism. So there's an article online from October 13, 2006, kind of me discussing some of these things. But I picked these three songs because these are very, certainly the last two are very, well, maybe start with the last one, we'll end with the third one, which is appropriate, right? We'll end with the end. But Across the Universe is one of the more difficult songs to understand. The lyrics are very cryptic. So we'll play that first, listen to it, and follow along with the lyrics, and then we'll discuss it.
And I'll just see if this Diet Coke is okay. Cleaning out the whole department.
Drifting through my open mind, possessing that currency.
This is repetitive. So what's your name?
Sorry, Peter.
Peter. Hi. All right, Jules, Neil, and Bella. Okay. So across the universe, so John Lennon said that he thought this was his best writing. He thought this was the most poetic song he'd ever written. And it's got a very interesting genesis. So the first two lines here, words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. So, let's say the first line. So that sounds beautiful, right? What's he talking about? So, as an interesting note, he admitted that he came up with this line one night. He was having a conversation with his wife, and he felt like his wife was talking and talking and talking and, like, was just wouldn't stop talking. And what came to mind was, words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. Like, it's like, she doesn't stop talking. It's like endless rain. So he said that's how the song started. That line popped in his head when she wouldn't stop talking. And he said, well, he said, that's a beautiful line for a song, but I can't write a song about my wife wouldn't stop talking. So he said, let's make this something a little deeper. And he said then his mind kind of got into a cosmic place and he developed this song. So what is this talking about? It's a very much discussed song, so let's kind of go through it. So it starts out with, words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither while they pass, they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my open mind, possessing and caressing me. Then it goes into Jai Guru Deva Om, which most people understand as just a... it's a mystical reference to God, but it's seen as kind of a... so what's the term? Like in yoga, or when you're meditating, you come back to a certain phrase over and over again.
Namaste.
What?
Mantra.
Yeah, your mantra, right.
Oh,
so it was like a form of a mantra. And then he switches into, nothing's going to change my world, nothing's going to change my world. And that's the pattern for the entire song. So we have the kind of this cryptic poetic verses. Then we have the mantra, which is a reference to God. And then we have, nothing's going to change my world, twice. So... what is he saying? So how do you understand? Let's take the first four lines. How do you understand what he's saying here? So let's read together. Let's see what we can come up with here. So words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither while they pass. They slip away across the universe. So what happens to these words?
Sounds like nothing much happens, that they just slip away.
Right, so they slither by, right? They kind of...
Well, he's going from a very specific, very specific minutia, very fleeting, ephemeral observation to a much bigger cosmic appreciation.
Okay.
In the space of half a phrase.
Okay. Okay, right, so exactly. So But these words, they... So the words are flowing out, then they pass by him, then they slip away across the universe. They just kind of disappear into the great expanse of the universe.
But I think that the most brilliant phrase is like endless rain into a paper cup, because the paper cup can't hold the endless rain.
Okay, and then, and it's and the paper cup is temporary by definition.
Right.
Okay, good. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my open mind, possessing and caressing me. Okay. So what does that mean? So pools, and that now it's somewhat of a reference to the rain earlier. So the rain is gathering on some level, but it's not pools of rain, it's pools of sorrow, and it's waves of joy. So we're still using the water imagery, but now he's shifting from water into emotion. And there's pools of sorrow and waves of joy are drifting through my open mind, and it's possessing and caressing him. So, and I think, let's go to the second similar paragraph, and let's see if we can kind of figure out a theme to all this. Images of broken light, which dance before me like a million eyes, they call me on and on across the universe. Thoughts meander like a restless wind inside a letterbox, which is like a mailbox in British English. Inside a letterbox, they tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe. So, what I see here is an imagery of, in one sense, a constant changing, and yet not real change, right? Constantly shifting from one thing to the next. So we've got, in the beginning, we've got the words, they're flowing, they're out there. The words are coming to him, but they slither by and disappear into the universe. They don't really enter. Images of broken light which dance before me like a million eyes, they call me, so I'm called by all this light from around the universe. Thoughts meander in my mind, right, like wind inside a letterbox. They tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe. So again, I've got these thoughts and I've got these emotions and I've got these words that are coming in, they're coming out, but they're not sticking, right? Nothing seems to stick.
You
right?
know what it's like? You know the famous Jewish folktale, feathers in the wind. It sounds okay. Like yeah. Words get out.
Right. Everything is just kind of dissipating out into the universe again. It seems like they're there, they're approaching, or maybe they're even rattling around in his mind, but they're not sticking. Okay? And why aren't they sticking? Why are none of these things sticking? Why aren't they lasting? Why are they all so fleeting? So I think this is how he gets back to his rejoinder. So Jagrudeva Om, so that's the idea of meditation and focus, right? You're focusing with your mantra. Then nothing's going to change my world. And here's the problem. The problem is he's not letting anything in because I don't want anything to change my world, right? All these things are coming. I've got these emotions that are potentially very powerful. And I've got these words that are potentially very meaningful. And I've got these thoughts that are very interesting and insightful. But I'm not letting them actually change my world because I don't want to deal with what that means. So to me, I think that's what the theme of this song is about, is that it's the human experience of having all of these potential influences around us and yet not letting them really impact us. Okay, I think that's what his message is here. And this, so we've got the across the universe, which is just kind of showing the expanse of things, which can almost make us feel so small that it's irrelevant. And yet the stubbornness of the individual, in one sense, we feel so small because, right, if he had said across the world, across the universe is an imagery that makes us feel very small, right? Who am I? What do my thoughts matter in comparison to the universe, right? If you think that way, nothing really matters in the end. Nothing. No one matters in the end. At the same time, the human experience is that we're aware how irrelevant we are, and yet we're stubborn about not wanting to change because we have too much sense of self-importance, right? So the human experience is this very strange, dichotomy. In one sense, we know we're irrelevant. In the other sense, we think we're so important. And somehow that coexists all in the human experience. And so I think that's what he's saying, is that in one sense, I feel fleeting, and everything is fleeting. It's all across the universe, and yet nothing's going to change my world. I'm still stubborn. I have to do things my way. So I think that there's an interesting little balance here. What do you guys think about that? Agree, disagree, what do you think? Any other insights you have? You like it? Okay, good. Okay. If you go on a little bit more, so, sounds of laughter, shades of joy are ringing through my open views, inciting and inviting me. Limitless, undying love, which shines around me like a million suns, it calls me on and on across the universe. So, here we have laughter, we have love, all these things through my open, they're inciting and inviting me, they're trying to connect with me, they're trying to get me to care, they're trying to get me to be a part of something, and it's not working. And it's not working. And, right, there's limitless undying love around me. There's love all around me if I would just connect to it. It calls me across the universe, and yet I'm still not letting it come in. So I think that's the message here. So in 1980, John Lennon did an interview. So full disclosure is with Playboy magazine. So you say the rabbi quoted Playboy tonight. This was the day that he died. I'm sorry, you're right. It was.
That's interesting.
No, it was published.
It was published later, but I think the interviews were. Well, the photo shoot was.
The photo shoot was. Yeah, I mean, the photo shoot was. Yes, yes. The interview was in September, but the photo shoot was that day. Okay. So this is what he said. So he's talking about what the 80s are going to be like. This is 1980, right? So it's interesting. He talks about the 60s. And then gets into the 70s, and he talks about how the 60s were this time of rebellion and time of kind of loosening the strains and non-conforming, but it led to some, you know, a lot of broken families and people not being able to commit and be responsible. And then the 70s, he said, the 70s were taking all the bad parts of the 60s to the extreme. That's what he says. That the 70s were just, you know, all about, it was a me generation, it was all about you, you know, people weren't interested in anybody else. So kind of took that lesson from the 60s. And now the 80s, he thought, were going to be the time when people can kind of get back to almost traditional values and family. And, you know, he talked a lot about his relationship with his wife and their commitment to each other and his son, and he talked a lot about that. But he talked a little bit about this. This is what he says. So what is the 80s dream to you, John? So you said, well, you make your own dream. That's the Beatles story, isn't it? That's Yoko's story. That's what I'm saying now. Produce your own dream. If you want to save Peru, go save Peru. It's quite possible to do anything, but not to put it on the leaders and the leaders in the parking meters. I don't know. I don't fully get that line. The meters in the.
That's from Bob Dylan.
That's a Bob Dylan line? Okay, fine. Okay, thank you. Don't expect Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan, or John Lennon, or Yoko Ono, or Bob Dylan, or Jesus Christ to come and do it for you. You have to do it yourself. That's what the great masters and mistresses have been saying ever since time began. They can point the way, leave signposts and little instructions in various books that are now called holy and worshipped for the cover of the book and not for what it says. But the instructions are all there for all to see, have always been and always will be. And he's asked, what is it that keeps people from accepting that message? It's the fear of the unknown. The unknown is what it is, and to be frightened of it is what sends everybody scurrying around chasing dreams, illusions, wars, peace, love, and hate. All that's an illusion. Unknown is what it is. Accept that it's unknown, and it's plain sailing. Everything is unknown, then you have the game. That's what it is, right? So I think what he's saying, and the theme throughout the interview, is that I think he's kind of focusing on this point a little bit. Is that, you know, the frustration of humanity is that people just don't want to do anything, right? Or that when it comes down to it, even if the messages are all around them, right? You've got all these wonderful books and leaders and inspiring people, but ultimately, they can't do it for you. You can't expect somebody to create your religious or your spiritual experience or your personal growth. No one can do it for you. You have to take responsibility. And I think that's a big part of what this song is about. is that you've got all these things around you impacting you, these words and these emotions and love and all these people, and they're all there. You just have to let it in, and you ultimately are responsible to make that happen. But if you keep saying nothing's going to change my world, then it doesn't matter what the books say. It doesn't matter, you know, who you're around. It's not going to go anywhere. You have to make that commitment to be willing to let that all in. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. That was a good connection. So how does this connect to Jewish texts? So let's look at some sources here. Source. Someone by wondering. Sorry.
Before,
yeah.
Can I just ask one thing about this? The refrain that nothing's going to change.
Sure.
Because, you know, I mean, I agree with every your take on this. I think it's very interesting. But when I've always heard this song, I thought the chorus wasn't really a rejection of all of these experiences, but that the song was full of melancholy because I always heard it as, you know, he's signing all of these very positive, wonderful things.
Are you looking for the Gemara share?
Yeah.
Oh, it's upstairs.
When?
Upstairs, right now, upstairs.
Okay.
Sorry.
He's citing all, you know, he's praising all these wonderful states of being and love and connection, and then insisting that nothing is going to change. But the quality of the music and my feeling that, you know, everything always changes, that the sadness of the song is really more, you know, that we can't, none of us stay in that state forever, that the world does change. Your world changes, my world changes, whether we like it or not. So that's how I always interpreted that.
So all these things that are happening around me, just say it again, I didn't fully know. Okay.
Well, just that, I mean, the way you presented it, and maybe your reading, you know, is more accurate than mine.
Yeah.
But you said that, you know, that this line, nothing's going to change my world, is the singer's, you know, not allowing himself to connect to all of these
right.
beautiful things around him. And I always heard it more that it wasn't that he wasn't connected, but that he's like in this blissful state and he's saying nothing's going to change.
I mean, he's hoping nothing changes.
Right, exactly, but he's hoping nothing changes.
From your... did you finish?
Well, yeah.
From your interpretation, I infer that nothing's going to change my world is sarcastic, like the song Short People Got No Reason to Live, which some people took seriously and were objecting to.
I'm sarcastic.
Sarcastic.
I guess what the way I look at it is because he says my world. To me, nothing changed my world to me means my approach, my life, my behavior, not the world. Right? So, to me, that's a personal, very personal experience. Nothing's going to change my world. So, the way I read it, you're right. I'm not saying it's 100%, right? This is my interpretation.
No, because, you know, if he loved Yoko Ono so much, you know, why would he say, you know, that love doesn't, he doesn't...
Well, he wrote this song in 67. I don't...
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He was married to his first wife when he wrote this song. This is before Yoko Ono. So she wasn't. We can't blame Yoko Ono for this one. yeah, maybe everything else.
Nice, his first wife Cynthia.
Yeah, well, I'm saying that, like I said, he started writing this song because he got tired of his wife talking so much.
Yeah.
So
it was Cynthia.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe that led to the divorce.
It's not necessarily a great portrayal of Cynthia.
yeah, it was not. So. But then he took that line and wrote the song, I think, pretty quickly afterwards. So he wrote it in 67, but it came out, I think, in 68. Yeah.
So you were going to relate it to the text?
Yeah. So, okay. Okay, so let's somebody want to read sources 1 and 2 here? Any volunteers? Neil,
sure.
Take it away.
God Elohim created man in his image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply and fill the land and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over every beast that walks upon the earth.
Okay, and then number 2.
The eternal God, Hashem Elohim, formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils a breath of life. And man thus became a living soul. The eternal God planted a garden in Eden to the east. There he placed the man that he formed to cultivate it and to watch it.
Okay, so what are the different commandments that Adam is given? He's told to do a few different things here.
Have children.
Yeah. Have children. But how is it described? To do what? The people multiply, to fill the land and subdue it. To have dominion over the fish of the birds of the sky and over every beast that walks upon the earth. How would you describe God's commandment to him there?
To control.
To control, to rule, to have power. Right? So the first commandment is, I want you to control this world. Okay? I want you to take control, to have power. Now, what's the second one? Right? Now, these are the two kind of creation accounts that are intertwined in many ways. So here, Hashem formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man thus became a living soul. The eternal God planted a garden, Eden, to the east. There he placed the man that he formed to cultivate it and to watch it. This is take care of the earth, to protect the earth. And that now, as opposed to the first time when there's a physical creation, but the focus on his task is more physical, right? To subdue, to have power. It's not really a spiritual commandment, right? This now is a little bit more of a spiritual commandment. You're obligated to, so now you're a living soul. You're here to cultivate and to watch, and not just the Garden of Eden, but really the world as a whole, right? So we're instructed in one sense to have power, to subdue, to control, and the other sense, we're instructed to cultivate, to grow, and to protect, and to watch. And so we're given kind of these two separate commandments, really two separate mindsets simultaneously. And I think this could be in some ways what the song is referring to, and you take a little bit different slant on it, is that we in our own minds have to switch between the builder and the cultivator. And in some ways, if you can look at it, the 6 days of creation and the seventh day of Shabbat, right? That we are told 6 days to work and to build and to create, and seventh day to not be spiritual. It's a hard transition to make. It's a very hard transition to make. It's hard to go from the mindset of build, create, control, to step back and now be spiritual and be humble. It's a very difficult transition to make, and to be both of those things in one person. And like we said, that becomes a big challenge of humanity. You know, we're a lot of walking contradictions. Like we said earlier, in one sense, we're irrelevant in the grand scope of the universe, and yet we're very important because we're in the image of God. We're told to be builders and creators and controllers and dominate, but yet to cultivate and to watch. And so I think here that's kind of what this is referring to, is that the human being just has some inherent contradictions in our mission that it makes it very difficult to keep on fluctuating between the two. I think Rav Soloveitchik puts it very nice in source number 3.
Can I comment?
Sure.
I don't see a relationship between sources 1 and 2 and the song. I think the song is about resistance to change and the fact that words can just fly by you and not have an effect. I don't think it's about control of the universe.
No, it's not. I guess my point... Let's see source number 3, then I'll see how I'm connecting a little bit. You want to do source number 3? You want to read number 3?
Thanks. What can the man of faith, who is moved by sensitive reasons of the heart, say to a society which is governed by pragmatic reasons of the mind? But the loneliness gripping the man of faith in the modern world is compounded because he is confronted not only by competitive faiths with their own forms of worship and transcendent claims, but by a pervasive and permissive culture which is ideologically secular and technologically successful. Religious faith is condescendingly regarded as a subjective palliative, but is given little credence as a repository of truth.
So, I think what Soloveitchik is getting at is that certainly in modern times, the natural, where do our minds tend to go? Do our minds go to human being as creator, as ruler, as dominating and subduing, or do our minds go to living soul, cultivate, watch, protect, spiritual? And he's writing this, you know, in the early 1970s, right? Now even more so, we live in a world of technology, and the world of technology is to continue to try to rule the earth, right? Our goal is ultimately to control everything we can control, and we get very frustrated when we can't control, because it seems to go against our very being, right? I mean, that's the hurricane coming our way now, I think, just showed that it was very difficult for people. We can't control this. Well, what can we do to stop it? What can we do to protect ourselves? What can we do to prevent it next time? You really can't. I mean, we'd love to believe we can. And there's things you can do to make it, you know, so to prevent damage. But we can't control it. And
where do you see that in the Rev's words?
No, what I'm saying is that when he says here that the what can the man of faith who is moved by sensitive reasons of the heart say to a society which is governed by pragmatic reasons of the mind? And I think that's what he's referring to. And also at the end, but by a pervasive and permissive culture which is ideologically secular and technologically successful. And I think the idea of being technologically successful is that our minds are becoming more and more wired to think of ourselves as creators and rulers of the earth, right? And it's much harder for us now more than ever to step back into being spiritual beings that are humbled. It's much harder for us to do that now. And not only that, but if you want to be spiritual and humbled, so that's looked at derisively, and that's what it says at the end here, religious faith is condescendingly regarded as a subjective palliative, but is given little credence as a repository of truth. Okay, if you want to be silly, okay, if you need to believe in something, so believe in something. Okay, fine, if you need that, then do it. It's not real, it's not truth, it's subjective belief, because, you know, it's kind of a weakness, but we all have a weakness a little bit. So you'll believe in something. Okay, fine. But that's not real. That's something you need psychologically, you know, to kind of get through hard times or to give yourself something to hold on to or to pass down to your kids. I mean, that is the secular approach and more and more pervasive approach, even amongst those who consider themselves more religious. And so I think he's saying here is that we're given these two mentalities, but we veer towards, you know, source one over source two, as ruler and dominator instead of as the humble cultivator and spiritual. So I think that's my point a little bit, is that maybe you can say that across the universe, the cause of nothing's going to change my world is when we look at ourselves as ruler, creator, dominator. So that's where nothing's going to change my world, because all the spiritual, it will pass through, but I don't want to get too close, because I don't want to start looking at myself that way. I don't want to start being that person. I don't want to define myself as a spiritual, humble being. I want to view myself as strong and independent and builder and creator. So that's why maybe that's when nothing's going to change my world. I mean, that's my point. So that could be kind of maybe the motivation of the mindset of nothing's going to change my world, that all these emotional, intellectual, spiritual things are around me, and I'm not letting them sink in because I don't want them to sink in. Because I don't want to become that being. I want to just have that on the side. You hear what I'm saying, Abella?
Yeah.
Okay.
Except, you know, when he's talking about the words, he's not saying that they're intellectual. I think he's saying that they're trivial.
Well, that's if you take the Cynthia story. You know, we have to take the Cynthia story out of it because he goes away from that. Yeah, I think he's going away from that literal. Yeah, we only read it that way because we know the backstory. But I think the song itself, he He says he got away from that mentality. Let's go to song number two, Baby You're a Rich Man. Not one of the more popular Beatles songs, but it's a great song. You know, it's not one of the famous ones. Yeah. Not one of the famous ones. But that's why I'm picking it. So Baby You're a Rich Man is a combination of two different songs. Okay? Lennon wrote all the parts except Baby You're a Rich Man. The lines Baby You're a Rich Man, that was Paul. And John wrote all the other parts of the song, and they kind of combined them. And they did this a few times. So they did this with most famously with "Day in the Life." Yeah. They basically took two different songs and combined them. But even a song like "I'm Looking Through You," if you know "I'm Looking Through You," so John had written the majority of the song, but it was missing something. It was missing a chorus. So Paul wrote a chorus for it. That when you listen to it, kind of fits in, kind of doesn't. So they did this quite often. And when it comes to the With help, they also, yeah.
"My Life" also wrote the melody, John wrote the
words. Okay, right. So, I mean, that's how they became, you know, a writing team. Across the Universe was all John, but they would always, even if one of them wrote it, they'd still write Lennon McCartney. But that was all John who wrote Across the Universe music and lyrics. So this was the combination. And it's in some ways it works, in some ways it seems a little bit forced to combine the two songs, but we'll see what we can do with it. Now, two side notes on this song. They got a little bit of a notorious history because Charles Manson, in one of the killings, after they murdered one of their victims, he wrote in blood in the door of the house, "How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people?" The first line from the song, okay, which shows a little bit how he understood the song, because he was going to rich, wealthy people's houses and murdering, you know, they were murdering them. And so that's a bit of a notorious past. When you listen to the song, so there is a bit of a...
You've been saying they, sorry? We. Was it one person, Charles Manson?
No, he had these girls.
Family. Girls, guys.
These girls.
Family.
Yeah, they had this, like, cult.
He
didn't kill anybody. He had a cult.
He commanded people.
It was a group of teenage girls that he got to commit these...
Murders.
Wow. I was born after that time, so I don't know anything. I never.
It's pretty.
This is not a topic I really explored.
Oh yeah. So they mostly went to wealthy houses near Los Angeles, and they murdered people. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was a big Beatles fan. You know, Revolution was a big thing he talked about. So. Now, from a Jewish side, there's a bit of some say apocryphal. If you listen closely, the line here over and over again, as you can see from the lyrics, is "Baby, you're a rich man. Baby, you're a rich man too." Every line goes "Baby, you're a rich man too." So some people say that at the end, instead of "Baby, you're a rich man too," John says "Baby, you're a rich fag Jew," yeah. Right? And that's a reference to Brian Epstein, their manager, who was Jewish and was openly gay. And, well, eventually he was openly gay. I'm sorry, what?
And in love with
so
John.
So some say he was in love with John. Right. So there's all sorts of interesting backstories or rumors about that. Brian Epstein, they had a bit of a complicated relationship. He signed them very early on. He made a lot of money, but he also was very good for their careers and made them very successful. But some say certainly John didn't really like him, and over time their relationship went sour. So you can listen. You know, some people think they're hearing "You're a rich fag Jew." Some people say, no, that's not what he's saying. He's really saying "You're a rich man too." So we'll listen to the song now, and you can see if what you think. I don't think so either.
I've
never heard that. It's
Strawberry Fields by Barry Paul.
Right. Right. So some people say that John would throw in funny lyrics sometimes, and certainly when there was when he was like a backup singer, he would just kind of make fun of it. Listen.
Didn't they publish the lyrics?
They did, but that doesn't mean he can't in the background have fun with it.
Thank you. is that George in the sitcom?
At the end.
Yeah, and
the... Yeah, because it diverges a little bit at the very end. You'll see. Right. Because it sounds a little different for the first time. That could be right. Yeah.
I think they threw an extra, a different note.
A different note, or they just, they elongated it or tweaked it, yeah. Yeah, I don't, but
not that, I mean,
it's out there, just so we know it's out there. Yes. Okay, what is the song about? How do you guys understand what the song is about? Let's start from the beginning.
Sure.
What do you guys think? Oh yeah, pour me a cup also, please. Thanks. What is this about?
Being wealthy, the how cool it is to be wealthy. keep all your money in a big pound inside a zoo.
So that's the line that people have the hardest time with. What does that mean, to keep all your money in a big brown bag inside a zoo? What is that referring to? So we'll get to that. I'll get to what I think that is. So okay, let's start. How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people now that you know who you are? What does that mean? If they're beautiful, they didn't know that, they just found out? What does that mean?
Yeah, somewhat. In other words, so now that you've made it, now you see that you're one of them.
Okay, so now, so this is referring to a type of person who is now one of the beautiful, right? How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people now that you know who you are? You weren't always this, but now you are this.
That's how they identify themselves at this point.
Right. So, what does it mean that they're the beautiful people?
The elite, you know, the rich and famous. You started out just like one of us, and now you made it big, and, you know.
Right. This could be referring to themselves.
Yeah, actually, probably more so than their manager, and they're a lot more famous than their manager.
Yeah, well, I don't think the song's about the manager. Some people think the song's about the manager.
Oh,
I don't think that's the case.
But it can't be about John, because it could be autobiographical.
It could be about all of them.
Not saying me.
It could be about the experience of somebody who has made it big, right? But wasn't big.
Right.
And is now adjusting to that new life.
Yeah.
Right? So how does it feel to be one of the beautiful people now that you know who you are? Like, you have to, this is who you are now. You can't pretend that nothing has changed. Everything has changed. What do you want to be, and have you traveled very far? So as far as the eye can see, I've been everywhere. I've done everything. How does it feel to be one of the people, and how often have you been there often enough to know? So I've been famous, I've been rich enough to know what this is now, right? I'm not so new to it that I'm adjusting to it. Now it's my new reality.
I think that this is talking about the egotistical nature of these people. Once they identify themselves as the rich and famous, you start to ask them, oh, have you been there? Oh, I've been there. I've traveled as far as anybody can go, you know?
Right. I've been bragging a little bit.
Exactly. It's starting to become... I mean, we've all met these type of people who have been... They say they've been everywhere all over the globe, and...
they've done whatever they want. They've done this, I've done that. Okay.
Right. And they show their boring slideshows.
By saying, how does it feel being one of the beautiful people? I mean, there's a lot of sarcasm and satire in that one line. Like,
right.
It'd be very different if the line was more like, you know... I can't think of it often. I'm so wedded to that line.
So, how do you enjoy being successful?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. No, for sure.
Yeah. How do you like fame and wealth?
Right.
How do you like being? How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people? It's very self-aware and knowing, and I think it's also a very funny song.
Yeah.
And people don't often talk about the Beatles' humor, but there's a lot of humor in a lot of their
movies. A lot of humor, for sure, for sure. Yeah. Right, so yeah, I think that there's definitely a sarcasm here. I mean, the beautiful people, in the term you've used today, is a reference to people who think that they're, you know, that they're hot stuff. So, it's somewhat of a derisive, right, mistrust for people in this situation. You know, you have to prove to me that you're not one of these people, right? And this could be, to a certain extent, I mean, you think about the Beatles' experience themselves, you know, when they make it big in 63, 64, so first they're wrapped up in it, and they're traveling, and they're doing concerts where girls are screaming, and they're making all this money, and they're meeting the Queen, and they're doing all these things. And at some point, there's a switch that goes off on them. They stop being as concerned about it. In 1966, they go on their last tour. They do their last live show in San Francisco, Candlestick Park, and they're tired of the whole thing, right? And I think their music changes, it gets more sophisticated. I think, to me, one of the things that makes the Beatles great is they don't stop growing musically, intellectually, right? If you listen to the early Beatles, it kind of sounds, you know, it sounds very trite, right? Love Me Do, and I Want to Hold Your Hand, and really until Rubber Soul, I think that's when it really starts to get more sophisticated. The lyrics get more sophisticated, more political, more analytical. And so I think this is the process that they went through in some level, you know, with drugs along the way to help. And so I think he's kind of referring to maybe what they went through and just people in this experience. And so Baby, You're a Rich Man is just saying, so again, it's Paul's song being thrown in, but I think the connection is, you know, this is who you are now. You're the rich man. You're the beautiful person. Now, what does this mean? You keep all your money in a big brown bag inside the zoo. What a thing to do. How do you understand that line? So, I don't know. No one seems to understand what it is. I'll tell you what I think what it means. Just my guess. I think it means you've got all this money. What are you doing with it? You're hoarding it. You're putting it in a bag, you're putting it, the zoo is like the bank maybe or something. It's like you're hoarding the money, you're not giving it away, you're not giving it to charity, not using it for good. You're just hoarding the money. So what's the point of that? What a thing to do. You're just hoarding the money. It could be used for so many, you know, so many better things. I don't know.
All this money isn't even doing you or anyone anything.
Any good. It's just sitting there, right. It's just
hiding it in the zoo.
You're just hiding it in the bag and zoo. Does no one even know? No one even sees
but
it.
He's saying that he's not even spending his money. In other words, he's just
or at the very least, not doing anything good with it. He's just wasting it. Maybe wasting it. Maybe hoarding it. I don't know. Something like that.
Well, I think actually it does imply that he's not really spending it.
Right.
He says you keep all your money in a big brown bag inside.
You're not doing it for like a lot of people today. A lot of people who are successful today. They all have their own foundations and stuff like that.
Right.
He's not doing. He could be doing better things. With
right. Exactly. Right. I think that's what it means.
But hoarding all that money and maintaining his level of wealth gives him the cushion to keep on talking about everything from a platform of I know everything. In other words, he's never going to become poor because he's hoarding it, but that'll allow him to always stay on a pedestal saying, oh, I know everything, I've been everywhere.
Yes. So that's a motivation to hoard the money.
Exactly
out of fear,
right, because he stays as part of that group of the rich people. If you give it away, then you become a normal person again. And you,
right, and that's his fear. This person's fear is to...
Right, okay. but the big brown bag line probably is the key to the whole song, because especially ending the song with the, you know, going from that line to the back to the chorus one final time, that's sort of where it reaches, you know, the height of the irony of the song, because the singer is saying, yeah, baby, you're a rich man, when he is in fact, or he is sort of on paper, but he clearly, you know, isn't really doing anything with the wealth. So I think by the end of the song, it's sort of bringing the whole idea of being a rich man into question and, you know...
Right, and what's the value of it?
What is the value if you happen to be rich, but you're not actually putting that wealth to any use
right.
whatsoever?
No, for sure, for sure.
Okay.
So, and I was thinking about... the connection in the Torah to this. And I think this week's Parsha is actually an excellent connection, happens to be. I think Joseph is one of the strongest connectors to this. So let's see a few verses in the Torah here. So what makes Joseph so interesting is, you know, he's the, of all of our ancestors, he's the rock star, right? And he's described in the Torah as good looking, as charming, as successful with women, successful in business, successful. He gets a tremendous amount of power, right? He is the superstar, right? And he goes through this process, right? Because the process of being the super talented, successful, good-looking person is a difficult process. And in some ways, a process only people in that experience can really understand, right? Everyone always judges people in positions of power, people are successful, but they don't really know what it's like, right? It's almost impossible for the outsider to really analyze what they've done or how they've done it unless you're actually in it. And maybe that's why the Beatles can do it, because who was more powerful, successful, and popular than them? So let's see source number one here. So this is the 39th chapter of Bereshit of Genesis 21-22. Vayhi Hashem et Yosef vayat vayet elav chaser vayitain chino ve'enei sar bet ha'sohar vayitain sar bet ha'sohar biyad Yosef et kol ha'asirim shebet ha'sohar v'et kol asher osim sham hu haya oseh. I'll read in English now.
Can I just ask, is it Shamos?
Yeah, I'll collect it. Yeah, we'll put it away. Yeah, it is. Hashem was with Joseph, and he endowed him with charisma, and he put his favor in the eyes of the prison warden. The prison warden placed all inmates of the prison in Joseph's custody, and everything that was done there he would accomplish. So this is a pattern of behavior with Joseph, that he gets put into a situation, he starts off from the bottom of the totem pole, and becomes extremely successful. So first it happens in the house of Potiphar, where he's sold as a slave, and then within a few years, Potiphar literally just gives him the entire house and says, you're running my house now. And he gets so much trust, he's really not treated as a slave, he's treated as part of the family. Then he gets thrown in jail because he's so successful that Potiphar's wife tries to sleep with him. He rejects her, and then she accuses him of rape, he gets thrown in jail. And then in jail, he impresses the warden so much. I mean, you ever heard such a thing? The warden's like, hey, you're great, you're running the jail now, right? I'm a prisoner. And then, you know, he gets, he meets Paro, he interprets Paro's dreams from jail. He comes out of jail, and Paro makes him second in command. He goes from prisoner, who is accused of raping the wife of one of the most powerful people in the country, to second in command in the country. We're talking about a level of charisma and intelligence and looks, this combination that is almost unheard of. I mean, his ability to charm. So if you look at Rashi here, and the bottom, so it says, Vaisheha mekubal akol roav, that anyone who he met was just charmed by him, was just like was, took him in, that they were just, he just had this force of personality. that no matter who he encountered, no matter what situation he was in, he just became, you know, incredibly successful. And in the beginning of his life, this was a very dangerous tool for him. It gets him in a lot of trouble, right? It makes his brothers very jealous of him. And then it gets him in trouble because he becomes so successful and a little bit too concerned about his looks and his appearance that Potiphar's wife now tries to seduce him. And the process of Joseph's life is realizing his success and his charm, but not being, you know, but not being wowed by himself. It's the ability to realize his success, but not to find himself based on that success. To, in some ways, look outside of himself and then objectively look at himself. And that's the hardest thing, right? The hardest thing for someone who becomes rich and successful is to be objective about themselves, is to have any sort of self-awareness, because you just assume over time that you really are this incredible. And only when you fall a little bit do you then realize that maybe I'm not as incredible as I thought. And I think the process of Joseph getting sold into slavery, being thrown in jail, is a process he needed to go through. Because without it, he would never have learned the modesty needed to really become a real leader, instead of just a charmer. You can be a charmer and accomplish nothing, right? That you can be a con man as a charmer. You can get away with all sorts of things. But to use that charm and actually become a real leader that accomplishes something in life, you have to go through a real process of growth and humility. So I think that's kind of what this is. That's what this is a little bit. This process that he has to go through. So I think that's, you know, to me, a kind of a similar theme. If you look here at source number 4 on the last page, there's a very interesting source here. It's one of my favorite passages in the Talmud. So this is from Yoma 35a. It's a Talmud that talks about Yom Kippur, but it talks about all sorts of things. So here we have this story. It's not a literal story. It's an allegory. As a lot of the stories are in the Talmud. Someone want to read number? Read the source. Want to read?
Sure.
The person who spent.
Yeah. The person who spent his life sinning came before God after his death. It was asked, "Why didn't you learn Torah in your lifetime?" And if you say because you were good-looking and therefore you were busy giving in to your desires, there was no one better-looking than Joseph. Every day the wife of Potiphar would say to him, "Lie with me." And she would change her clothes multiple times during the day to entice him. She then threatened to have him put in jail and physical harm inflicted upon him and offered large sums of money, none of which swayed him. For he said, "I don't want to sleep with you in this world and then be in the same place as you in the world to come."
Great line there to end the story. Let's focus on the beginning for a bit. So the give and take here is a person dies, goes before God, and God asks him, "Why didn't you learn Torah in your lifetime?" And what's his answer? His answer is, "Because I was good looking, and therefore I was busy giving in to my desires." What kind of answer is that? It's like, well, why didn't you learn Torah? "Oh, because I was too busy sleeping with women." I know, that's my question, right? That's the question. Well, what's his response?
Well, he doesn't actually say that.
Right? He doesn't, like if you're going to say this, I'll say this.
Well,
right.
That's
it's like a lawyerly...
Yeah, but it's a very interesting sort of way of setting up.
I mean, sure. I can see why you're connecting it to the song, because his answer to Hashem is, "I got caught up in my own persona. I started to, you know, I got caught up in my own, what I looked as myself as being a good-looking person, so therefore I got caught up in that, and I just kept on going with the flow, as opposed to breaking out of that mold and saying, okay, what do I need to do to enhance my spiritual self, or go down a different path?"
Right, or not define myself as that.
Right.
Right, so I think what the potential argument this person could make to God is, well, wait, I didn't make myself good-looking. Hashem, you made me good-looking. Right? You made this difficult for me. If I wasn't good-looking, then I wouldn't have had all these temptations. So God, it's your fault that I did this. Right? That's the potential argument. Right? And God's saying, you have a point, but Joseph was able to do it. right? So for some people, you know, there's all, and this passage in the Gemara, there's two others just like it that follow it. One, the rich person who says, I couldn't learn Torah, I had too much money to take care of. And the poor person says, I couldn't learn Torah because I had no money and I had to, you know, scrape, I had to work 24/7 just to scrape to get by. And to all of them, Hashem says, you don't have an excuse, right? No matter what your life circumstance is, because you're really successful, you're really not successful, you can break out of that mold and grow yourself, grow your character and grow your spiritual self. There's no excuses. And not only does God say there's no excuses, God brings examples throughout history. Here's someone who is in your situation, but even more so, and look what they were able to do. Because what's interesting about this response from Hashem is that it never says that the question God asks is, why didn't you learn Torah? But Joseph, it doesn't say he learned Torah. So you say your question?
No, just...
Yeah, it doesn't say that Yosef learned Torah. It just says he didn't sleep with Potiphar's wife. Right? That's not the same thing. But the point is...
Well, Torah wasn't given yet, so that's hard to learn Torah.
True. Okay. But I think that the point is the same. Meaning, you didn't learn Torah because you always defined yourself based on your charm and your looks, your money, your success. You weren't able to look outside of yourself, look at yourself objectively and say, this is what I am, this is the skills that I have, how can I use this for good? And how do I have modesty within that? So I think that's the message that Yosef really taught us. And I think that's the lesson of the song. That if you're going to, you know, if you're going to be one of the beautiful people, now they know you are, what do you want to be? What are you going to do with this now? Right? Now, have you thought about this? If you look down a little bit, we didn't do this part. How does it feel to be one of the beautiful people tuned to a natural E? That people understand as being like a very... You're at the same level. You're not really questioning yourself. You're not really growing. You're staying at the same key, right? Happy to be that way. I don't want to change. I'm doing my thing now. I don't want to change. Now that you found another key, what are you going to play? But if I introduce you to another way of thinking, so now what are you going to do with your life, right? What are you going to do with all this? And I think that's kind of the message of the song. I think it's a very deep message. Like you said, it's a little sarcastic. It's cute. It's, you know, it's obviously a beautiful song. But the lessons here are just fantastic. That's what I think. And there just aren't many bands that you can really analyze songs like this. And I think as we're going through, we all begin to see, well, he said, I see it this way, I see it that way. I see there's something here, it's a little deeper. And I think we just took two songs, and we could have taken 20 more and done the same thing. So a little something to think about as we celebrate John Lennon's Yahrzeit this coming week. And any questions or anything?
I just want to say, The other thing is, who's going to like to analyze our Simon and Garfunkel?
Yes, that's true. Not quite the same. I find them a little bit...
I heard they're studied as poetry at Columbia.
Yeah, I love their music too. I find the Beatles a little bit more profound. I don't know. I don't know. But the one song I will not analyze is Come Together. I have no idea what any of that is.
It's a play on words.
I don't know enough. I haven't studied. Yeah, it's a lot of nonsense. I don't know what to do with that song.
No, nothing.
Yeah, nothing with it. These songs I can grapple with. A few others. There are a few others that we can give. I think these are the two that I find the most interesting. All right.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
My pleasure. So, I didn't catch your name.
Richie.
I'm sorry.
Richie.
Richie, what?
Mentor.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Rabbi.
When I was in Israel a few months ago, I met somebody who gets on the Israel radio and does I think once a week or something, he does a talk show about the Beatles. And he's like the Beatles expert of Israel. So everybody who listens to him and knows him as that. So we were at a shiva together. We had some time to talk. He said that somehow he spoke to Yoko Ono relatively recently and invited her to come to Israel, and she refused to come because of the... Palestinian situation.
Well, it's not, was there any reason why she just for those reasons? Or because of her safety or because of any particular...
No, she felt as though the situation between Israel... in other words, we know that she's a very left-wing, you know, peacenik, so she... sides with the Palestinians.
She sides with the Palestinians.
She doesn't side with them to the extent that she says Israel is wrong, but she says I won't come to a place that's involved in conflict. I think you should make peace with your neighbors.
Well, I agree with that. But I'm saying